Part of Psalm 19. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the comb. By them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then will I be blameless, innocent of great transgressions. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. One of the, should I say, many frustrations I had as a young mum was the fact that when my children were given a gift of a children's Bible, they were sometimes beautiful books, beautifully illustrated. But when I read the stories through, particularly the Old Testament stories, they may as well have been fairy tales. The children could read the story about David and Goliath and then read Jack and the Beanstalk, and they were both about giants. And apart from taking some moral from the story, there was really nothing that separated the Bible stories from any of the other stories that they read. The New Testament ones were different because they brought in introduced Jesus to them. But the Old Testament stories were just stories. And that always concerned me. And I'd go into bookshops, even to Word and to Kurong, and have a look at the children's Bibles, especially if I wanted to give a gift to somebody. And it wasn't until the last few years when Jesus, the storybook Bible, was written and came on the market. Have you all read that one? Yeah. That it became clear, even in the writing of that, that every story from the beginning was made into a part of a unified whole that pointed to Jesus, that talked about what God intended for this world and how he was going to bring his son into the world. In talking about this, and talking about sermon series and so on with Michael, I had this in mind when I suggested to him that after having all this year, having wonderful people speaking and giving their testimonies, and as Morris said last week, we don't want to let that go. To have people in part of our own Christian family speak of the testimony that is theirs of God walking their life is a wonderful thing to share. But at the same time, it would be great if we could, if when we were speaking, we could have some unified series to go through. A little bit tricky when you've got different person every week to take a book of the Bible and go through chapter by chapter, because quite often the chapters are, the way they're divided up is not necessarily logical in terms of a preaching series. And so I suggested something that we're going to do. And that is that each person that speaks each week is to take up something from the Old Testament, anything from the Old Testament. And in their speaking, bring out two things. First of all, what does it tell us about the character of God? And how does this passage point to Jesus? So this is giving you a heads up to all those who may be going to speak next week, next month, whenever. Search the Old Testament. Now you've got more than about two-thirds of the Bible to choose from. Any part of the Old Testament to talk about the what this tells us about the character of God and how it points to Jesus. Today's passage that I'm going to look at is from Genesis. And just to give you a little bit of background of how I came to it, when I was leading communion and when I've heard others leading communion, we very frequently talk about the passage that Jesus spoke in Matthew and then Paul reiterates in Corinthians in his letter, that when Jesus took the wine, he said, "This is the new covenant in my blood." And I thought, well, I've said those words so many times, I've heard those words so many times, but I'm not quite sure what it means. And if this was the new covenant, what was the old covenant? In fact, what is a covenant? A covenant's not a word we use very often these days. I think in modern parlance, the only time I've heard it is in connection with a block of land. Someone might correct me with this, but where you have a covenant on a piece of land that you're buying, quite often that means it's a section of the land you can't build on because there might be easements or something. But also it can mean if the piece of the block of land is in a particular area, the covenant on the land might be that you can only plant native trees, or you can't chop down the trees that are there, or that you, so that you have to have a certain streetscape, or that you can only build in brick, or you can only paint, you know, the outside a certain colour or something. So I've heard of those sort of covenants. But the biblical covenant is different from that. Biblical covenant not only has this legal aspect to it, but it also has an aspect of love and relationship. When I started looking into the background of this, and of course, I go down a rabbit hole, you know. I find something and I want to dig down into it. I realised, and Jude will be able to tell you more than this because I know that she's done an essay on covenants, that there are at least three old covenants that I knew of: the covenant God made with Noah, and the one God made with Abram, and the one God made with Moses and the Israelite people. And it seemed to me that from the beginning of creation, God has invested in human beings. What he's wanted them from them is to partner with him in creation and to oversee his creation. But unfortunately, every time he invested in a person or a group of people, they became corrupted, and consequently, they corrupted creation. Starting with Adam and Eve, of course, they corrupted things from the very beginning, and then one of their sons, Cain, became a murderer, straight up. So within one generation, we've got a murderer on our hands. And then Cain went off about, I think, three or four greats later. Along his line was Lamech, who was a dreadful man, the first polygamist that we read about, and a vengeful murderer. So that quite clearly that whole line had become quite corrupt. And then what God seems to do is to take a remnant of the people, a selection of one or two of the people who were left, who were not corrupted, and work with them. So in Adam's family, he took Seth. And if you go down the line of Seth, you come to Noah. So regardless of who else was corrupted along the way, and obviously a whole lot of them were, got to a point where God could see that the whole world was completely so not what was meant to be, and so corrupt and so murderous to each other, that he chose Noah, who was part of that line of Seth. He took that remnant of Noah's family, and save them. Then, of course, Noah was saved, and he had three sons. So what happens with them? We've got Japheth and we've got Ham. Ham was the father of the Canaanites, who were known for their lasciviousness, and you go down the line there. Nimrod was one of those offshoots. He established Babylon and Assyria and Nineveh and the Philistines. They don't have all that good reputation for knowing, following God. The one remnant that was left, that was faithful, was Shem. And followed down his line, and we come to Abram. And again, God took the remnant, the one or two or one family that he felt that he could work with. It just amazes me. God is so persistent. How must God have felt to see such corruption and destruction of his creation? It bewilders me. Last week, I think it was, John and I were watching an episode of Landline, and Pip Courtney, who's the presenter, was going back to look at a farm that she'd been to 20 years before. And the original farmer on that land, 10 years previous to that, so we're now going back 30 years, had done the absolute unthinkable for farmers. And instead of clearing all the land, which is what everyone else had done, he planted trees everywhere. He planted trees in rows, he planted trees in sections, he created waterways, he created not just digging a dam, but created habitat for native animals. Then his son took over that land. Of course, everyone thought he was insane, the politicians included. That why would you be trying to run stock and putting trees on the land when everyone else was cutting them down? Anyway, Pip went back, and now the grandson has taken over this land, and it is the most glorious property you've ever seen. Just presumably they had a drone going and seeing it so you could get a bird's eye view of it. But the thing that the grandson was able to say was not only was he able to hold on to the dream that his grandfather had, but the property was way more profitable than way more prosperous than the other land where everything had been cleared. That there was a certain percentage, for instance, if they were lambing or calving, there's a certain percentage that they knew they'd lose every year just because of, cold or predators or something. But because the stock were protected by the land, they didn't have those losses. And so they were getting much greater production with half the land being covered with trees. And it made me think, what would the grandfather... I mean, that's a good news story. But what would the grandfather have felt like if the son and then the grandson, and presumably there were other siblings in the family, had decided this was all nonsense and they're going to do what everyone else was doing? Chopped down the trees, made a quick profit... Arguments amongst the siblings, so they sold off half the land. Someone married someone who didn't want to stay on the land but wanted to get a bit of profit from them, so forced them to sell it up and divide it. How would that grandfather have felt? It would have broken his heart. And that's just a little taste of what God must feel. It must break his heart to see what the people that he loved, when he's created something beautiful for them, what they've done to it. And yet he is so persistent. If the grandfather had known in advance that the worst was going to happen, probably if it'd been me, you would have just sold it up and said, that's it, I'm going into aged care place, I'll just divvy up the money and that's it. I don't expect you to do anything with the farm. But God doesn't do that. He takes a remnant each time and persists with them. And how much harder, I mean, sowers know this, how much harder is it to take something you've messed up or take something that needs mending to actually fix it than it is just to put it in a bag and forget about it or throw it away? It's much harder to mend something that is broken than it is just to start again. But God persists with us. I want to look today at the covenant that God made with Abram. And it's very clear that he wanted to establish a relationship with Abram. And he started off on three separate occasions that are recorded in making promises to Abram. Back in chapter 12, the Lord said to Abram, "Go forth from your land and your birthplace and your father's house to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who damn you I will curse, and all the clans of the earth through you shall be blessed." And Abram went forth. And then a chapter later, he makes a similar promise. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, "Raise your eyes and look out from the place where you are to the north and the south and the east and the west, for all the land you see, to you I will give it, and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed like the dust of the earth." Could a man count the dust of the earth? So too your seed might be counted. Rise, walk about the land through its length and its breadth, for to you I will give it. And then again, in chapter 15, he makes similar promises. "And now the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This one will not be your heir,'" because Abram was saying that, "Well, I don't have a son, therefore I'm going to have to adopt someone and make him the heir. 'This one will not be your heir, but he who issues from your loins will be your heir.' And he took him outside and he said, 'Look up to the heavens and count the stars, if you can count them.' And he said, 'So shall be your seed.'" Three times God made those promises, patiently building up a relationship with Abram, and Abram was able to trust him. Now, the thing that in comparing the different covenants, and I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here, but that's all right. The thing that came to me when I was looking at these three covenants, but each one of them was made after some salvation. Salvation was its starting point. So Noah was saved from the flood. And then a covenant was made with Noah. Abram was called out to be blessed. He was called out from the lands and whatever was happening in those other lands. Then the covenant, which is yet to come. So far there have been promises, but the covenant hasn't been made yet. In the case of the Israelites, he saved the Israelites from Egypt. And then the covenant was made with them. If Jesus is the new covenant, our salvation has come first. He saved us. That's jumping ahead. But can you see the link of where it's going. God covenants with each of the surviving groups because those that are left or those that are saved are to be the bearers of God's promise for the next age. And I think that applies to us too. Now, this is the passage that caught my eye because in some ways it's quite bizarre. This is from Genesis chapter 15, from verse 8. And God said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit. And Abram said, Oh, my master, Lord, how shall I know that I shall inherit? And God said, Take me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old she-goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And he took all of these and clothed them through the middle. Just cut them in the middle. And each set his part opposite the other. But the birds he did not cleave. And carrion birds came down on the carcasses and Abram drove them off. And as the sun was about to set, a deep slumber fell upon Abram. And now a great dark dread came falling upon him. What was the reason for the dark dread? This little thing that he's gone through seems quite bizarre to us. But Abram doesn't react at all to having to take these animals and cut them in half and line half the pieces up on one side and half the pieces up on the other side facing each other. Because he knew that that was a fairly common way of making a covenant. In fact, the Hebrew words for doing this, for making a covenant, are literally called cutting a covenant. And this was something that happened between, say, two kings that were making an agreement about things, that they'd become allies and they're making an agreement. They'd cut a covenant and then each of them would walk down the pieces of carved up animal. And this was a ritual that signified that if I do not keep my side of the bargain, may I be cut up, chopped up, the way these animals have been. Now, that sort of covenant was frequently done between peers, between landowners, between kings. If it was ever done between a king and a person of lower rank, then it was the person of lower rank that walked through between their cut animals, never the king. And that was a sign that I will be loyal to you, dear king, and if I'm not, this is what will happen to me. I can't imagine that happening at Government House on Australia Day for all the people that are given citizenship. The closest thing that we have to the idea of a covenant relationship that we have is marriage, and we still don't ask people to do that. Maybe divorce would take on a whole new aspect if they were the consequences of breaking a covenant. So Abram didn't react at having to do this, because he knew that a covenant was about to be made. But he did have this dark dread, because this was a covenant that was being made between him and God, clearly. So effectively God was the king. God wasn't going to be walking down between the pieces. He was. And God had made promises to him So clearly, there were promises that he was expected to keep. And if he didn't, then these would be the consequences. Now, the only things that have been asked of him so far were to be obedient and to be trusting. So far, he had been obedient and trusting. But he knew that in walking between these animals, he was going to have to be obedient and trusting every single inch of the way for the rest of his life. Otherwise, these would be the consequences. And as we know, in the very next chapter, we know, because we know the story, that he didn't trust that God could give him an heir. So he has intercourse with Sarah's handmaiden and thinks that, well, he'll adopt that son. And a whole lot of consequences come from that. So Abram knew his own flaws. So he went into this sense of dread. But let's read what happens. And this is absolutely astonishing. A deep slumber fell upon Abram, and now a great dark dread came falling upon him. And God said to Abram, "Know well that your seed shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and afflicted 400 years, which was the time that the Israelites were in Egypt. But upon the nation for whom they slave, I will bring judgment, and afterward they shall come forth with great substance. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in ripe old age. And in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." This is the bit. "And just as the sun had set, there was a thick gloom. And look, a smoking brazier with a flaming torch passed between those parts. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your seed I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite.' When was another time that God appeared in fire and smoke? Yet to the Israelites, God couldn't appear in his glory to Abraham. But a brazier, which was the presence of God, walked down between the parts. And Abram must have thought, uh-oh, now it's my turn. But why has God gone down? Because God was never required Abram to walk between the parts. Because what he was saying was that, "I am making this covenant of you, with you. I will keep my promise. I will maintain a relationship with you. And if I do not, then may I be cut up like these parts. But not only that, I'm not requiring you to walk between the parts, because if you don't keep your part of the bargain, let me be cut up like these parts." And centuries later, he was. What grace. This was a covenant of grace. And to honour this promise, God would bring his people out of Egypt, and he'd bring his son into the world. In Zechariah's song in Luke chapter 1, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come and has redeemed his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he said through his holy prophets of long ago, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham, to rescue us from the hand of our enemies and to enable us to serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days." What grace and what faithfulness. Doesn't that make you want to gasp in wonder at the awesomeness of God? Doesn't it make you want to kneel before his grandeur and to prostrate yourself before his majesty? Doesn't it make you want to cover your sin from his holiness and shield your eyes from his glory? Doesn't it want to make you reach out your hand for his forgiveness and nestle in his arms of grace? Doesn't it make you want to return love for his love and for his faithfulness?